Tonight we're involved in the discussion of something that is very near and dear to my heart, and that is our families, and especially our children. In the book of Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, the Bible says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" In these two short verses, we read of God's creation of the family, male and female, man and woman, joined together in marriage with blessing from God. And that blessing from God, I believe, was to be fruitful and multiply. God blessed mankind with a command to be fruitful and multiply, and that is to have children. From the beginning, before the Old Testament, before the New Testament, it was God's plan in creation for men and women in the institution of marriage to bear and to raise children. And I believe that God presents this as a blessing. In Psalms chapter 127, verse 3, the writer said, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward." Again, the point here is that God sees and intends children to be a blessing to the family, a blessing to the church, and a blessing to society in general. And so in Psalms 127, verse 5, "Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them." And I don't know, let me say as we begin, of any other blessing from God that people, and even Christian people, would reject and refuse as they sometimes do concerning children. Sometimes people treat children with indifference, or they consider them some kind of ball and chain that they have to drag along behind them. I don't believe that's the picture that God intended and that God presented in the Bible. I believe the first priority or that God gives men and women is the relationship of marriage. Women have as a priority their husbands. Husbands have as a first priority their wives. And then come the children. And children are a blessing intended by God for our happiness. Now, just now, I want to say that I'm not a child-raising expert, and I would never claim to be such a thing. But then again, I don't have all that much confidence in the expertise of those who say that they are experts. I believe that parents are so different in their makeup and that children are so different that there is a no one-size-fits-all kind of solution to all the problems that we may face with children. And having said that, though, I do have four children, and today they range in age from 30 to 20, and all of them are Christian, and for that, I thank God. Now, considering children, there are some things we assume. We assume love. In Titus chapter 2, verse 4, Titus or Paul tells the older women to admonish the younger women to love their children. And so we assume that's kind of something as you begin to talk about children, and I'm not here to train you to love your children. We're going to assume that people love their children. Although, I think that can be a mistaken assumption. As we look around the world that we live in, we note that the Apostle Paul in the world that he lived in Romans chapter 1, verse 31, in his list of things that he considered as all unrighteousness, he lists from the New King James Version, unloving. The Old King James Version said, without natural affection. And that came from a Greek word, storgos, without love of kindred. And Vine says, especially the love of parents for children and children for parents. Sometimes folks are unloving. They don't have that natural kind of love. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, Paul included this same word in his description of the people in the last days, that they will be unloving, without natural affection. So we might assume that parents will love their children, but we might assume wrong. And failure to love our children will almost certainly result in failure in the role of parents. But for the purposes of this lesson, we're going to assume love. And we're going to assume that we as Christians, we talk about love a lot. And if we ever learn anything about love, we need to learn about love for our children. All right, a second thing we're going to assume is that children are trainable. It may be that some are not. Those with various sorts of mental damage or some sort, even those, may be trainable. But we're going to assume that children are trainable. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6 says, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." And really all I want to take from that is that children are trainable. I think that's what God is teaching. I also think that God is teaching that as parents, we are capable of training our children. God doesn't ask us to do anything that we are not capable of. I don't know that Proverbs 22 and 6 is an absolute promise. I don't know if it's a general rule, but whatever it is, it would seem to be the case that it teaches that in the majority of cases, if a child is properly trained up in right and wrong when he is old, he will not depart from it. I believe God is not interested in seeing even one child be lost. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, he is not willing that any should perish. I certainly believe that that applies to children as well as adults. And we could probably talk about some other verses, Matthew 18, Matthew 19. God is interested in the salvation of children. In order to bring about the salvation of children, he put them into the hands of their parents. And there's a whole discussion. God put them into the hands of their parents and not into the hands of, I believe, the government. Parents are to engage in the training of their children, and parents are able to train their children, and our children are able to be trained. They are teachable and amazingly so. Now, I was given some questions to answer as well, and I want to talk about at least some of them. I'm not going to name them as Greg did, because if I don't get to the end, you'll never know. Anyway, first question, what does the Bible teach about the disciplining of children in general, and in particular, what about spanking? Now, leading into this, I want to share something with you that was meaningful in my life. And I just titled this little section, Things I Learned in Dog Obedience School. And about 22 years ago, before my youngest son was born, we were given a dog, a puppy Rottweiler, and that makes some bearing on the situation, on the condition that we would take her to puppy training school and that we would do that. I kind of put it off until one day I looked out the back window and that 25-pound Rottweiler was on my youngest daughter, Rebecca, on top of her. She was lying on the ground and his mouth was around her neck. I thought, oh. My response, I burst out the back door and I kicked that dog off. I didn't want to tell you that because I was ashamed of that action, kicking that dog off. I should have done something else. But that's what I did. That was my reaction. My next reaction was to sign up for puppy training school. I figured out we need this. And you'll see this in a little bit. The first thing I learned about that dog in puppy training school was this dog is not an especially quick learner or interested in learning. In fact, that dog and I took that number one beginning obedience training three times in the next year and a half. Course number one. But to be honest, it wasn't course number three that I learned lesson number one. It took me one, two, three to get what I really needed to learn right off the bat. This class is for me. It's me that needs to be trained. And if I can get trained, the dog will get trained. And I just have to tell you, I grew to love that dog. I took that dog to Africa with me, and I think that's the best dog I ever had in my whole life. You can get me crying talking about that dog. Old Yeller, Muffin had you beat every day. The most important thing I learned was it starts with me. If I can get trained, that dog can get trained too. Number two, start with simple things, age-related. Things that the dog can learn, communicate it clearly, what I want to the dog. The dog can't talk, so I have to use my hands, I have to use the leash. I repeat and I practice those things every day, not just at class, but every day at home. The class trains me, lesson number one, and I train the dog at home every day. And that became part of me and that dog. That's why I probably learned to love that dog, because I worked with it every day. Well, I invest time into the dog. The dog gets trained. If I don't invest the time into the dog doesn't get trained, and I learned that. If the dog doesn't get trained, I'm probably going to blame the dog and call it a dumb dog or some such thing. Same with the child. I don't invest the time in the child. The child doesn't get trained. I'm probably going to blame the child. And it was me that didn't get trained in the whole situation. Number three thing I learned to praise all the time. If you can't spend time praising, voice, physically, hands-on, commending for right things accomplished, then you really have no right to physical discipline. And that's the question here. That's the question. What about spanking? You don't spend the time training the dog, physical, hands-on, voice. Good dog, you know. Someone told me they like the high-pitched sound. I did that. You don't do that. You don't have the right to physical discipline. You work to find the right opportunity to praise, establish a positive relationship, praise before negative discipline. Number four, say no at direct disobedience. Teach no, and you teach no when the dog is on a leash, while you have direct control. You're able to physically stop the wrong action. What about a child? What about a one-year-old child? He, she is across the room, begins to do something wrong, play with the electrical outlet, or hit another child, pinch or bite, some such action. You see the action begin to take place. You grab their attention with the word no as you're on your way. You don't just sit on the couch. I've seen too many people tell their children across the room no and sit on the couch and shake their heads when they don't. You don't sit there and say no. You get up and you get over there. You get your hands on and you say no. And you stop the action from taking place. That's part of the whole thing. Once you get them out of the situation, you find another way to love and praise. My dog, it was always sit, stay, come. Practice those things all 10 years I had that dog. Before I left Africa and left the dog there every day. Yeah, sit, stay, come. She obeyed those perfectly. I found an opportunity to say, good dog, again. Relationships all fixed. No matter what happened in the correction phase, relationships all fixed with me and the dog. And if the situation continues, then after that, number five, physical punishment. Jerk of the leash on the dog, a newspaper maybe. Stop the wrong action. And then again, lead the dog through a correct action. Return to praise, child. You stop the action. You lead through a correct action. It may seem like sometimes that physical punishment, someone may say, well, that came first. No, it didn't. We started way back here working on this whole process. And if physical punishment is ever needed, it didn't start. That wasn't the beginning of the day. We always started somewhere else. Now, concerning a dog, I believe that if you want an angry or a discouraged dog that has no interest in obeying, you just start beating the dog before, perhaps for a real wrong the dog did, before you haven't established a relationship of praise and communication. You get a confused and angry dog who's not interested in obeying you. You think about Paul's words, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5. Fathers, do not provoke your children. One of the ways you provoke your children is to expect correct behavior before you invested time in training and teaching them that correct behavior. So now, having said all that, things I learned in dog obedience school. That's really what I learned in dog obedience school. Disciplining children. First, let's talk about that. The word discipline is only found four times in the New King James Version of the Bible. Twice that I thought might be of some interest to us. In Proverbs 13 and verse 24, the Bible says, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Discipline comes from love and reflects love. No discipline, no love. Now, in this verse, discipline is certainly connected to a rod, to physical spanking. And I believe that's what's under consideration here. It's a rod. Proverbs 22, verse 15 calls it a rod of correction, a rod whose purpose is correction. Well, there's another place where discipline might be interesting to us. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27. It's not about children. It's about Paul himself. He says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should be disqualified. So the point and purpose of discipline is the subjection of the body, to bring the behavior of the body under control. However, for the real study that we want to engage in this evening, I want to go to the book of Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, because Paul addresses fathers here, and this has always been so impressive to me. This is no small point. One of the great problems in our families is the absentee father, the father who is not there for some reason or another because he's so invested in his work, because he loves his hobbies, because he's not interested in his family. Children need their fathers. And Paul is under revelation from God here pointing this out. And you fathers, he says, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training, New King James Version, in the training and admonition of the Lord. The word training here, nurture, bring them up in the nurture and admonition, Old King James Version. I note Titus 2:4, mothers were taught to love. Sometimes fathers need to be taught to nurture. That word is training here in the New King James Version. If we were reading in the New American Standard Version, it would be discipline. And the Greek word is paideia, something like that. And the same word is found in the book of Hebrews chapter 12, that paideia word. Hebrews chapter 12, and we're going to read a passage there. Of course, Hebrews chapter 12, we're going to read verses 5 through 11 when we get there. The same word is found, the noun form, same as in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, is found in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6, 7, and 5, 7, 8, and 11, the noun form. Hebrews 12, 6, 7, and 10, the verb form. And these words mean instruction, discipline, correction, or chastening. And so in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5, Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 through 11, the Bible says, "And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons." The assumption is every child that he's talking to has endured chastening from their fathers. "Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us. We paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." Chastening is the method of training. It involves instruction, it involves correction, and it involves chastening. It involves physical chastening. It's called scourging there in the beginning of that passage. This word is also, this word paideia, discipline, training, chastening, is also found in Luke 23, verse 16 and 22. And there it's the apostle, or it's the governor Pilate, Pontius Pilate, who says to the mob, he says about Jesus, "I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, I don't think that Pilate had in mind that he's going to give Paul a good talking to there. I believe that he had in mind that he's going to scourge him, that he's going to beat him, and maybe the crowd would be satisfied with that. And that makes it obvious that the word for training, correction, discipline can include to chastise with blows. But now let's go back to Ephesians 6, verse 4. "Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath." There are young people, children, teenagers, who seem to be full of anger. And Paul traces the problem back to fathers. Now, sometimes children get angry at their parents because they have to go to bed early, or they have to take a shower, or they have to mow the lawn, or they have to wash the dishes, or they can't drive the car tonight, or they have to, something like that. None of those things falls into the category of provoking a child to wrath. Sometimes a child has to own his own anger. But sometimes a parent has to own the child's anger. When a parent does not do what Paul says next, he has provoked the child to anger. Paul says next, "But bring them up." And again, the idea is nurture. And again, to bring them up is the idea of nurturing. Again, fathers, you need to learn to nurture children. Mothers have to bring your children up too. I don't know if we'll get to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 10. But to the widows, you know, the ones who might be supported. Have they done this? Have they brought up children, he says? Fathers are to bring up their children. Mothers are to bring up their children. It's a joint project here. When you bring up your children, that word nurture there is what you do when you feed, you house, you clothe, you school them. All those things are involved in the bringing up of the children. But that's not enough. Paul said you need to bring them up in the training. The word training here is that paideia word, instruct, train, discipline, correct. It includes the idea of chastening with blows. That could be spanking. Remember Proverbs 13 and verse 24, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him. And Proverbs 23 verse 13, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. And it's assumed there that whatever spanking is given is not enough to cause physical damage, to kill a child. That's not what correction is in the Bible. Biblical correction and discipline certainly included physical punishment. And I believe that's supported there by Hebrews 12, verse 6, which we read, for whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. Chastening is associated with scourging. Now today we live in a world that rejects the idea of physical correction. WebMD says on it that spanking, physical punishment, isn't recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I can't give you a history of how that all came to be. I speculate perhaps that in the face of real problems, real child abuse, the reaction becomes to condemn all physical correction and training. It's kind of like hedge building of what we talk about in the Old Testament. We see a problem and let's build a hedge. Let's keep them back. Let's don't let them do that. And so let's make a law around this whole thing that'll keep everyone from even getting close to anything that might be called abuse. And so it's legislated. Here's what you can and can't do. However, I believe the Bible supports the idea of physical correction and spanking. And when I say that, I don't mean face slapping, and I don't mean punching or bruising. And I'm familiar with families who have taken spanking too far. A long time ago, I came across a family who said to me that, and I think they said so braggingly and proudly, that they only spanked their child with 39 blows at a time, because that was one short of 40, and I was appalled. I couldn't believe that someone with children would spank 39 blows, and you'll see something here in a minute. I would present two rules for spanking. They're man-made, and they're mine. They're the ones that I used for myself and my children. I spanked my children, all four of them, and I limited my spanking. This was my rule. This is Roger's rule, and it was necessary, and this is something else. People say, don't spank them when you're angry. I was always upset when I spanked him. I never spanked him once, and I wasn't upset with him. Maybe once. And they got very light spanking that day. But I was always upset. But I had rules. And rule number one, they get one, two, three, and I'm done. Did I ever break my rule? Yeah, I did. Sometimes I missed them on one, and I gave them a fourth. And that's just the way it was. Rules kind of get busted. But I never gave them more than five. The rule, that's my hedge. One, two, three, and be done, Roger. It doesn't matter if you're upset. Be done with it. It's over and done with. Now, we might remember Proverbs 13:24 about promptly. You have to limit yourself. It's something that takes place not tomorrow. I never told my kids, tomorrow I'm going to spank you for that. I probably couldn't have lived the day, and I don't know what would have happened to them, but I never told them that. If they needed a spanking, they got one promptly. I limited myself. I'm not out of control. I may have been upset, but I wasn't out of control. You discipline yourself so that you can discipline your child. Another rule, number two, I would only had two, I guess. Spanking stopped at the age 12 for me and my family. In practice, that involved really a gradual replacement of spanking with other forms of correction. More and more talking, less and less spanking. My son Aaron, who is now 20, last time I talked on a subject like this, he was 8 years old. Maybe that speaks to the frequency that needs to be improved, but he was 8 years old. And at that time, I recognized, I wrote it down. Already, we have started the phase out. We just knew that. The phase, we were changing from the spanking mode to the other modes already at 8 years old. And my reasoning was, if a child is old enough to obey the gospel, I don't believe we ought to spank our brethren, our brothers and sisters. And so if our child is old enough to understand and obey the gospel, he or she is old enough to reason and to correct in various different ways. In light of this, spanking is for young children, and I believe the majority of it will be done between the ages of 2 and 10. Let's finish Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. Bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. The word admonition is from the Greek word nouthesia, training by word, encouragement, reproof, and warning. The words training and admonishment are not the same. They complement each other. Training emphasizes the act of teaching with correction. And admonish emphasizes the words that you talk to them. You talk to them. And you let them know what's right and what's wrong. Now we ask, may a parent whose job it is to bring up his or her children use physical discipline in the training of a child? Biblically, the answer is yes. I believe the Old Testament teaches it, and the New Testament, Hebrews 12, verses 5 and 6, and Ephesians 6 and 4, the word training support the Old Testament teaching. However, may is different than should, and I wanted to make the difference here. May is different than should. Should a parent use physical discipline on a child? I believe they should. I'm not all parents. I'm not all children, but I believe they should. An 18-month, two-year-old, I don't believe there's any adequate replacement for a slap on the hand or on the leg. If it's the hand that's offending, if it's the hand that's reaching into the bowl of food at the dinner table and you want to stop that, you could just take the temptation away from the child, but you missed an early opportunity to teach the child right there. Teach the child the meaning of the word no. You say no with that limited contact there. And you teach them that you're serious when you say no. If you wait till they're 8 to begin to do that little slap or something like that, I believe you've waited too light. The physical consequences, you waited too late for. Physical discipline missed at an early age when the intensity is low is a missed opportunity to teach a proper relationship between parents and children. Spanking is phased in at maybe at about a year old, and phased out by the time a child is 12. If I wanted to really tell him like myself, have I ever violated that rule? That'd be a good question. Well, the second question I was asked concerns education. The parents' role, and especially about homeschooling versus public schooling, had to do there. What about that? And I suppose that I was asked this question because my wife, Judy, and I raised our 4 children, and we homeschooled all 4, and you know what you got here. You got a prejudiced guy who has an opinion, and we'll talk just a little bit about that. So we homeschooled all 4 children from kindergarten through high school graduation. The older 3 of those children have college degrees, and the 4th is a junior in a state university in a speech pathology program. I say that. It's just the way it is. I just say that as evidence that homeschooling does not limit a child's educational potential. It doesn't. Parents certainly have a role and responsibility in the education of their children. When Paul said in Ephesians 6, verse 4, bring them up, feed, clothe, shelter, love, emotional support, educate. They're all involved in the bringing up of the child. And this bringing up is to be in the training and the admonition of the Lord. But I'll tell you that spiritual training doesn't happen in a vacuum, and it doesn't happen totally separate from secular training. There's an interaction between the two. Teaching a child to read will involve the opportunity to read a verse of the Bible. Children, obey your parents in the Lord is often one of the first verses in the Bible that children read, and it applies directly to them, and they learn to read, and some of the first stuff they read are some of the simpler verses of the Bible. When you train and teach in science, that's at least in some places going to involve the teaching about creation. And you're going to have the opportunities to do some creation teaching there. And so opportunities like this are lost when parents, when children go to public school. Those opportunities are lost. And we want to ask the question, why have parents and the church lost so many children? The world. I think it's about lost opportunities. I have one piece of paper here someplace that just kind of figures it out. How many hours do you think a child spends in public school between kindergarten and high school. I don't know, I was thinking about a workplace. If you spend 8 hours a day at a workplace, why, and then I half that. Nah, they don't spend that much. 1,000 hours a year in school away from parents. In 10 years, 10,000 hours. 10,000 hours of lost opportunities in a child's life. Can you overcome that lost 10,000 hours? Yeah, sometimes, with the help of the gospel. The gospel is God's power of salvation. And people with the gospel, sometimes we can overcome that 10,000-hour deficit, but not always. And when people wonder, sometimes when we lose so many children, I think, in large part, it's because of the public schools that we send our children to. In Exodus chapter 12, verses 26 to 27, the Bible says, "And it shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' Your children are going to ask you questions, and that's natural, and that's exactly as God planned it to be." There in Exodus chapter 12, verse 26 and 27, "It shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' that you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our household.'" So the people bowed their heads and worshiped. Parents are here involved. They're to be involved in the religious and the historical training of their children and their nation. Not in class, but in a situation where parents are accessible to the children so the children can ask their parents. In the book of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and the Old Testament is really, we could say the New Testament backs up the Old Testament in Ephesians 6 and 4, or the Old Testament backs up the New Testament. But Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, the Bible says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." Now, this is teaching that's going on here, and this is private teaching. And Paul talks about, or Moses talks about, private teaching. He also talks about public teaching. That's another thing, and the public teaching of our children. But private teaching, parent-child time teaching. Now, let me tell you, the homeschool situation exactly fits this exhortation. It provides time and opportunity for the teaching to happen. The homeschool situation also puts the parent, and this is what I think is really important, in the role of teacher. That is exactly the role that's described in Deuteronomy 6, verse 7. Now, ask your children, often children, in an outside school, public school, they have someone and they recognize someone besides a parent. Ask a 5 or 6 or 7 year old child, "What's your teacher's name?" What's their teacher's name? It's not mom and dad, I'll almost guarantee you. It's someone else. The public school system with professional teachers takes parents out of the role. It just takes them out of that role of parents as teachers of their children. But that's part of the role that God gives them. Often it's assumed that parents just cannot do as good a job as professionally trained teachers can do. In a family situation, that's just not true. And I'm not talking about maybe if you're trying to teach someone else's children, but in a family situation, that's just not true. As far as I know, there are no statistics that show that homeschooled students are less educated than public school students. And in fact, it's just the opposite. Sometimes I know statistics can be used to prove anything you want them to prove. But I would say that public school homeschoolers are no less educated than those in the public school. I'm a big advocate of homeschooling. I don't believe there's any downside that's serious to homeschooling. When you consider that homeschool education is just as good or better than, in some situations, than public school education, and that homeschooling allows the integration of spiritual and religious training to go hand in hand together, and it puts parents in the role of teacher, which is exactly the role that God gives them. Now, having said that, I don't believe that homeschooling is the answer for troubled children. I don't think that at all. If your children get to be in the 5th or 6th or 7th grade and they're rebellious and they're not doing well at school, I don't think that taking them out of public school will answer and solve that problem. There's a problem someplace, but I don't think saying, well, we're going to take them out of the public school and put them in a home school. I don't think that's the answer to the problem. I believe homeschooling works best when it begins as early as possible. What did I learn in dog obedience school number one? It's me that needs to get trained. When the parents can learn along with their children how to do it. If you can start sitting down with your one-year-old and reading books to them, and as they get to two, you're counting and talking and teaching the colors, and you're sharing God with them, and you're praying with your children, you're taking them to the library, and to various reading. If you're doing that with your children at 1, 2, and 3 years old, when they get to be 5, you can homeschool them in kindergarten. And if you can homeschool them in kindergarten, why can't you do it in first grade? You can. You've got to get trained, but you get trained right along with them. And that's how it really works. The Apostle Paul, someone says, he was taught by Gamaliel in Acts 22, verse 3. But F.F. Bruce, in a book called Paul, Apostle of the Heart Set Free, said, well, he, Paul, would have entered the school of Gamaliel at some point in his teens. Paul did not go to Gamaliel at 4 or 5 or even 6 or 7. He went in his teens. Now, education is part of bringing up a child, and as parents, we have options. And I need to say that. We have options. It's the parents' options. Homeschooling, private school, public school. And I believe for the spiritual welfare of the young child, homeschooling is the best option. It scares me to see children 4 and 5 being sent out from their Christian parents in their Christian home, being sent out to modern teachers trained in postmodern thought, teaching the children to look inside for truth and look inside for right and wrong. And for up to 8 hours a day to the best learning hours that there are, some of us survive. But the problem is too many are lost. It's kind of evolution, survival of the fittest. If I was asked about the dangers that parents face today in the world, the loss of opportunities in teaching our children, in doing our job as parents, that take place when we send our children out to public school is at the top of the list for me. Television's there and all that stuff. But the loss of opportunities, 10,000 hours of lost opportunities. Irvin Barnes, in a little tract, Raising Children, he says, don't turn your children over to the schools if the schools were worthy of our every moment of trust. He's right. His answer is to prepare them. He has an answer. Prepare them for the activities that they will not be able to participate in. Another answer is keep them at home. Homeschool. I want to be done here for the fear that I might try to convince someone to homeschool their children. It's not my decision. It's yours. I'm just saying, I don't think there's any downside to it. Question number 3. What does Paul mean when he says that women are to be homemakers in the book of Titus, chapter 2, verses 4 and 5? Titus, chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. The Bible says that they, the older women, admonish the young women to love their husbands and to love their children. To be discreet, chaste, homemakers is the word we're interested in. Good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Homemakers. Clearly, the realm of a woman's expertise is to be the home. In the book of 1 Timothy, chapter 5, which Greg mentioned as well, when Paul talked about the widow who might be taken into the number, that is, supported by the church, he said that woman must be 60 years old, she must, or above. She must have been the wife of one man, full of good works, have brought up children. Remember, that's like fathers are told to bring up children. Lodge strangers, wash saints' feet, involved in the service of the saints. Relieve the afflicted, involved in every good work. Verse 14, and the younger widows, my intention for them is that they marry and bear children and manage the house. Younger women, married, it's the general case, would bear children and manage the house. A married woman's job is a management job, is the idea there. It's a respectable job. It's to be respected. All work is that's legal is to be respected. But there is a respect that needs to be accorded to the woman who manages the home, manages the house. The question was asked, what can we do to encourage more women to take care of? There needs to be a respect for women who manage the house. I think part of the whole feminist movement, perhaps, is women want to be respected as the men are respected. They want that respect. And I don't have any problem with that. They need respect. And they need to be respected for managing the house. Now, this here in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 14, is a similar word to Titus chapter 2, verse 5, but it's not the same. In Titus 2, verse 5, they're to be homemakers. The New American Standard translates that as workers at home. And Vine says the word comes from the root for home, oikos, and the root word for ergon, work. Workers at home. The NIV translated as they need to be busy at home. The woman is to be the manager of the home, a worker at home, busy at home. Now, none of us would question or debate those things, especially. The question that comes to mind then, in my mind, I don't know what they had in mind, but the question that comes to my mind, if a woman is to be a worker at home, busy at home, what about a job outside the home? Well, to answer that question, I would just consider Ruth, of course, in Ruth chapter 2, verse 3, who gleaned in the field, not in the home, but in the field, and the woman Lydia, whom in Acts 16, verse 14, says she was a seller of purple, or the virtuous woman of Proverbs 31, verse 16, who bought and sold a field in order to plant a vineyard, and this is a businesswoman. None of that supersedes the business of women to be workers and busy at home. I don't know all of the women here, so I won't use you. I could use Greg Gay's wife, Cassie, who had a job. I think she may have retired by now. But she was a worker at home, and you could just know that. Or you could use my wife. She has a job. But her real job is our home. And that's who they are. They are, you know, my job is not who I am. That's who they are. They're their home. And that is the virtuous woman. None of whatever else a woman might do, it does not supersede the business of working, of women to be workers and busy at home. I think the idea that women are to be workers at home is not contrasted with can they work outside the home, but it's contrasted with verses such as 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 13. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 13 talks about those younger women and says, "And besides, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not." Women are to be busy at home. They're to be workers at home. And that's contrasted against that thought of women who cease to be busy at home and workers at home and begin to be idle and busybodies, going from house to house with gossip. That's the negative. The positive is to be a worker at home. Having said all that, I believe it's the best situation when a young woman with children devotes herself to managing the home and staying at home, to caring for and bringing up, along with the efforts of her husband, bringing up the children, not relieving the father in any way. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up. Fathers, it cannot be emphasized. Alongside the mother, your job is to bring up your children. And whatever we say about the mothers does not relieve the fathers of their job of bringing up children. The women perform their job as a help suitable to the man. I could say that it's all the man's job. And anything the woman does is help to him. She helps him. I'm done. Thank you very much.